I express my gratitude as well for our guests. Almost every assembly we have visitors that are family in some way or visitors from the community. And that certainly is a blessing to us. We appreciate your presence. Hope you benefit from being here and hope you feel welcome to come back again. In our study of the Bible, the way we're presenting the survey of the Bible is not so much of preaching as it is just textual studies. And we've come across some very interesting historical facts, some very interesting names that are unusual names that we don't run across all the time or use in a normal vocabulary. And I would suggest that perhaps it might be appropriate to take some of those names and apply them to people who may not have names that are quite so colorful. For instance, it might be appropriate to instead of naming Sharon, to call her Abishag. I think that might be a good name for her. And we might name Randy Adonijah. And somebody might suggest, well, maybe we better call Jim and Margaret Ahab and Jezebel. And so we might not pursue that to its limit. But the Bible records a very interesting historical people. And I don't mean by that they're always interesting from the standpoint that they're good people or they're good qualities about them. They certainly are not. And when you read this particular part of the history of the Bible, as we're studying in 1 Kings, it really is not an encouraging part of the Bible to read. It's not something that you would say, here is something that we just really enjoy looking at. And there are a lot of bright spots, but most of it really relates to a time in the history of Israel that is not a pleasant time to talk about. And it's not a time where there was great faith except on a very limited few. So as we were introduced to this second part of the book of Kings, 1 Kings, beginning in the 12th chapter, the significant fact that made this the part of the book that divided it as I divided it is that because here you have the division of the kingdom. Up to this point in time, under the rule of Saul, though it certainly was not the best kind of rule, under the rule of David, which they always in their history would go back to and talk about great King David, and then under the rule of Solomon, where the kingdom perhaps enjoyed its greatest time of prosperity, its greatest time of the extension of its borders, and the greatest time of peace, when they were not affected by the enemy. But then you find the deterioration. I think the deterioration began especially with the intermarriage of Solomon with many foreign women. And there was not only the influence of the nations immediately about them and that idolatry, but he brought in other women from other places, and with that you have a tremendous impact upon the people for committing all kinds of idol worship. Now that in fact precedes what took place in chapter 12. Chapter 11 in 1 Kings precedes that, and chapter 11 talks about that time in Solomon's life, and it says in his old age. Now, you raise the question, did he change? I don't know. If he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, then he did change. But if he did not write the book, then it conveys for us that he was a man with such tremendous wisdom and was such a great wise ruler. And yet he came to his end as one who was acting contrary to what his wisdom had been directed to so do. But now in the second part of Kings, we're looking at the kings as they are divided. And you remember that I challenged you to memorize the kings of the northern kingdom and the kings of the southern kingdom. I'll not ask for a show of hands. I suspect some of you have done that. I know that Jimmy could say the kings of the southern kingdom anyway. He'll not be called upon to stand up and recite those, but he could. And I'm going to give you a little more time. And the reason I'm going to give you a little more time, I must ashamedly confess, is I've not memorized them again yet. And I go through stages in which I will memorize them and then I'll forget them. Like the judges, I'll memorize them, won't use them for a while, and then I'll forget them. But I have pretty well conquered the 19 kings of the northern kingdom. And I'm perfecting that. And right now, as we finish the book of 1 Kings tonight, then we're really just going to get to the southern kingdom and Jehoshaphat, and we're going to finally close with Ahab. And then in the 21st, 22nd chapter of Kings, Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, begins to rule. And it just briefly introduces him. So So those are the kings that we're primarily interested in. And if you've memorized those kings of the northern and southern kingdom up to this point in time, then you are on schedule. And next week we'll proceed in the book of 2 Kings in a little more difficult period of time. Tonight as we start, let me review briefly. If you have your sheets that I gave you, the chronology of the kings, if you don't have those and you'd like to have one, I'll run off some more. But this shows you how that in the kings you have an overlapping. And in fact, I told you that many times when a king is introduced, it will say like he began to rule in the fifth year of the king of Israel. And then when it talks about the king of Israel, he began to rule in the fourth year of the king of Judah, or something like that. Because that was their way of dating time as the kings crossed over in the times of their rule. They did not always rule in the same year. Now, these kings, then this chart will explain to you how the kings would overlap and which king was ruling in the north and which was ruling in the south. And it shows you the time of the end, the demise of the northern kingdom in 722, and then finally in 586, the fall of the southern kingdom of Judah at the hands of Babylon. So all of that's taking place as we've introduced it here and will carry over into the book of 2 Kings. Now let me explain something else I'm doing as well. That when we get into 2 Kings, and especially we get into the days of Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, and then on into some other kings, we're going to see that the major prophets and many of the minor prophets are going to fit in this period of time. In fact, really, there are some prophets that predate this time of history that we're talking about here. And we'll pick those up and mention them very briefly. And at that point in time, we're going to look and say, now here's historically where this is taking place. And we'll take that book out of the Bible where it is arranged in the order that somebody put it, and we're going to plug it into the time of history in which it fits. And that way we're going to see that all of these things, how each of the books fits into that time frame reference. One thing that we remember in our review was that very early in the history of the northern kingdom, that God called a young prophet to go up and prophesy against the altar at Bethel. Remember that Jeroboam had built two altars. And he did this at Dan and Bethel in order that he might keep the people from going back down to Jerusalem, where the time would be for them to come down to Jerusalem and to worship. And that was required by law. It was a part of the system of the celebration of the feast days. And they would go back to Jerusalem to the temple to worship. So in order to keep them from going back there, he built altars at Dan and Bethel. And on those places, he erected idols, calves, to worship. So this prophet now is called upon by God to go and cry out against the altar at Bethel. The unusual thing about this, as a young prophet, he is very obedient. He goes and cries out against the altar. Jeroboam reaches forth his hand to stay, and his hand withers, and then his hand is healed. And he ought to understand that, yes, the very God that had told him that he was going to become a ruler over the northern kingdom should be respected and these idols should be done away with. But he's not affected that way. The young prophet begins his journey back home. The old prophet lies to him as he comes to his house and tells him that he's a prophet of God also, and God told him to come in to eat. And he does. He believes that. He believes a lie. And as a result of that, he dies. Well, many times we look at passages and we say, that really doesn't seem fair. And to us, it doesn't. And it's not right. And we raise the question in our mind, how could God then cause the young prophet to die when he believed the lie, but he didn't kill the old prophet who lied? Well, I can't explain that either. I just leave that into God's hands. We simply have the narrative as it exists. Now, the primary point of the passage really is to explain how that the prophet spoke against the altar, that Jeroboam was sufficiently warned about that idolatry, and he accomplished that task. The other parts are incidental, but that's the main part of the story. In the 14th chapter, we saw that Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, was sick, and Jeroboam's wife disguises herself, and she goes down to the prophet in Judah in order that she might perhaps get some answer from Ahijah, and there might be some relief for her son. Instead of getting relief, Ahijah tells her that when she goes back into the city, that Abijah is going to die. And then there's one comforting thing about his death, and that is that he will be buried But he says that all the rest of Jeroboam's children, those that die in the field will be eaten by the birds, those that die in the city will be eaten by the dogs. There are not going to be any descendants of Jeroboam who are going to be buried after Abijah dies. Then, as the 15th chapter begins, we find in verse 1 it says, in the 18th year of the king Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, began Abijam to reign over Judah. 3 years reigned he in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah. He walked in all the sins of his father. His heart was not perfect with Jehovah his God, as the heart of David his father. We're going to find that frequent reference is made back from one king to another, and back to one time of rule to another. In chapter 15 as well, we find that as Abijam rules over Judah, and he's followed by Asa. And Asa is a bright spot in the history of Judah because he was a good king. And it says that he removed the idols. Another very interesting thing that we said before, that we saw, that during the time where you have an evil king or a king who's committing idolatry, the land is identified as a time when there were the Sodomites. Now, we said the Sodomites, of course, relate to the perversion, the perverted practice of homosexuality. And so those things seem to go hand in hand. That when you begin to turn away from God and worship to God and worship idols, you turn away from standards of right. And the moral of mankind then degenerates. Now Asa removes the Sodomites. He gets rid of the idols, and he also removes the Sodomites. So his rule is a very good rule. And he's noted as being a good king, as a bright spot in the middle of several others who were not quite as good. And then in verse 16 of the 15th chapter, it says, there was a war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. You have people who are of the same descendants. They trace their tribal ancestry back to the sons of Jacob. They're called the Israelites because they were sons of Israel. And back beyond that, you trace them back to Abraham. But in the two nations now, you have the animosity and you have the warring. Very infrequently do you find these two nations who are at peace with each other. And so, briefly, in this part of history, you find the conflict between Baasha and the king of Judah, Asa. But then you also find that there is a conflict between the nation of Israel, and sometimes the nation of Judah, and the nation of Syria. Now, here's the reason for that, is because Syria is just to the north. But sometimes, as you find in the 18th verse, Asa, for instance, sent to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria. Now, the reason he did this is because he might get some relief from the oppression of the northern kingdom of Israel. And so they kind of make a confederation. He pays a certain amount, and as a result of that, then he gets the relief that he does from the help of the king of Syria. In verse 29, continuing of the 15th chapter, it says, it came to pass that as soon as he was king, he smote all the house of Jeroboam. This is Nadab, and this is in the lineage of Jeroboam. He smote all the house of Jeroboam. He left not to Jeroboam any that breathed until he had destroyed him. Now notice the next verse, the next part of the verse. According to the saying of Jehovah, which he spake by a servant Ahijah the Shilonite. What had Ahijah said? Well, you go back and read what we've already looked at in the 14th chapter, that when Abijah was sick, then Ahijah had prophesied that all the children of Jeroboam would die, and they would not be buried. The only one to be buried would be Abijah. So this happened, and it was through the efforts of Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, as he began to rule over the northern kingdom. Now, the rest of the acts of Nadab, it says in verse 31, written in Chronicles, let me inject this for a moment so we'll keep things in order. We're not going to be studying the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles as we're looking at 1st and 2nd Kings. We'll be correlating some of that information. But the reason we're not is because essentially what is covered in 1st and 2nd Kings is also covered in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. So rather than duplicating that information, we're just going to cross-reference some of the information that may be lacking from one historical account to the other. Now, as we pass from the 15th chapter and the destruction of the house of Jeroboam, and come to the 17th chapter, well, let me look at the last part of the 16th chapter, last part of chapter 16. What we have in chapter 16, it says, "The word of Jehovah came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha, saying, For as much as I exalted thee out of the dust, and made thee prince over my people Israel, and thou hast walked in the way of Jeroboam." Remember what I told you? Anytime one of these kings in succession of the northern kingdom was idolatrous, he was identifiable with the ways of Jeroboam. He first introduced the idols. And he says, "And hast made my people Israel to sin, to provoke me to anger with their sins. Behold, I will utterly sweep away Baasha and his house, and I will make thy house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Him that dieth in the city shall the dogs eat, and him that dieth in his field shall the birds of the heavens eat." Well, that's exactly what Ahijah had said when he prophesied to the wife of Jeroboam. So you find Jeroboam in the end of his house. You find Baasha in the same way. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to find another king. So just kind of put an asterisk beside your mind as you think about that. Another king. There are three kings of which God's prophet said that none of your sons will survive. They will all die, and they will not be buried. And in each instance, those that die in the field will be eaten by the birds, and those that die in the city will be eaten by the dogs. So it's true of the house of Baasha, as it was in the true in the house of Jeroboam. Now we turn from his rule, and briefly are introduced to the rule of Elah, his son, and he ruled for a short period of time. And he was overthrown by Zimri. And Zimri was the captain of half of his chariots. He rose up against him when he was drunk, and he killed him. And then, as we are reviewing, what happened was when Zimri hears that Omri is appointed king, then he is afraid. He goes into his house, the king's house, and he burns the house down around him. He certainly can't expect what's going to happen. But then in verse 25 of the 16th chapter, it says, "Omri did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah. He walked in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, his sons, wherein he had made Israel to sin, to provoke Jehovah, the God of Israel, to anger with their vanities." Now, here's what I really want to drive home from this chapter, the last part of this chapter that we closed as we were closing last Sunday evening. Ahab is the next one in order. So from Jeroboam and Baasha and then Elah, and then coming along, Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, you have Ahab in order. Ahab stands out probably as the worst of all the characters that you've ever seen, except maybe one character in the southern kingdom, one king in the southern kingdom who was especially identifiable with a murderer, and that was Manasseh. And when you look at Manasseh, when God talks about the fall of the southern kingdom, it's because of the sins of Manasseh, because of the bloodshed. He murdered so many people that the city just ran with blood. That was the descriptive figure that was used. But Ahab is the main character that occupies a lot of time in the recording of these events. Notice how he's described in the last part of chapter 16, verse 29 beginning. "The 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Ahab, the son of Omri, to reign over Israel. He reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Ahab, the son of Omri, did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah above all that were before him. And it came to pass, as it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took to wife Jezebel, the son of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. And he reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And Ahab made the Asherah, and Ahab did yet more to provoke Jehovah, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him." Now, briefly, we're going to look at the kind of character that Ahab was. What was he like? Well, the bright spot in the nation of Israel, in the rule of Ahab, focuses upon Elijah the prophet. And it's usually true that where you have a background that is so immoral, it's so degenerate, it's so away from God, that the brightness of a prophet like Elijah stands out even more. And Elijah is a man with no compromising spirit. It certainly is necessary to have a man like Elijah during the days of the rule of Ahab and Jezebel. Because the conflict, the evil is so strong that the stand for right, in order to try to right the ship of righteousness, must be even stronger. And many times there is a need for a man like Elijah when the days of the existence of man are very dark. God provided for Elijah, the 17th chapter, we find him introduced for the first time, and how that he was a prophet of God, how God provided for him by the brook and with the raven to feed him, the water from the brook, and then how the woman that he went to stay with the jar of meal and the cruse of oil, miraculously was provided. This provides a story many times that we teach our children. But again, we teach them that children without, we teach the story to the children without them understanding the context and background in which this took place. They need to know, as best as they can comprehend in some fashion, that Elijah was prophesying during the days of Ahab and Jezebel. And he was a prophet called by God to resist this strong evil that was pervading the whole land. Then in the 18th chapter, we are introduced to the time when the prophets of God were cut off by Jezebel. And you have another prophet, Obadiah, who saved 100 of God's prophets in the cave at his own risk. Now God calls Elijah, and he tells him that he wants him to meet with the prophets of Ahab and Jezebel, and then Elijah's going to propose this. So he approaches Obadiah and tells him to tell Ahab to come and meet him, and Obadiah is a little bit apprehensive about that. He says that, at my own risk, I've saved these prophets, and now you tell me that you want to meet Ahab, and I'm going to, we've been looking all over for you, he's been looking for you, and he can't find you, and you're not going to show up, and when you don't show up, he's going to kill me. And certainly Obadiah maybe had some merit for reasoning in that fashion. But nonetheless, Elijah said, I will meet Ahab, and so the time comes for them to meet. Chapter 18 and verse 16. Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. It came to pass when Ahab saw Elijah, that Elijah said to him, Is it thou troubler of Israel? Now who was the troubler? Was it Elijah that was the troubler of Israel? No, Elijah was just simply causing trouble because he was resisting the evil. Ahab was the one who introduced the evil, and Ahab and Jezebel were the ones who were permeating the land with the evil, and Elijah caused the trouble just because he was resisting it. But that's true many times when you find a conflict between good and evil. The contest is proposed that the prophets of Baal come, the belonging to Jezebel, and they will build an altar, and they will put a bullock upon that altar, and then they will cry to their gods, that the prophets of Baal will cry to their God to come down and consume the sacrifice. And Elijah says, if he's God, then we'll worship him. But then if God is God, then we will worship him. The people were in agreement with that. They said, it's well spoken. They were, and certainly they would be receptive to that. Well, this is a contest, I think, that's a very essential demonstration of the trueness of God. And you know the story, how that the prophets cut the sacrifice. They built the altar was built. They put the sacrifice on the altar. And they were calling upon the names of their gods to come and to consume the sacrifice. And he did not at 12 o'clock. And Elijah says, well, maybe they're asleep. Maybe you need to cry a little louder. And they cut themselves and anything that they possibly could do that would be the normal procedure to get the gods to speak to them, showing their deep devotion. And yet nothing happened. And then finally Elijah stepped up and he had them pour the water over the sacrifice, and it saturated the sacrifice and the wood and the ditch around the altar. And he called upon the name of God, and God came down and consumed the sacrifice and consumed the wood and consumed the altar. And then the people say, God is God. We will worship God. But how long did that last? Well, not very long. In fact, you find that still through the influence of Ahab and Jezebel, that the people follow them, and the land is still saturated with evil. As a result of this, the prophets of Baal, belonging to Jezebel, were killed. And then Jezebel made a vow that she was going to see that the same thing would happen to Elijah that happened to her prophets. If you'd been Elijah, what would you have done? Gone to the king's palace and said, "Hi, Jezebel, I'm here." No, you'd probably do what Elijah did. He fled. And he certainly was in a state of great despondency. It was a time of discouragement. I think we identify with that sometimes. We get the feeling we're the only ones who are really trying. And sometimes when we get discouraged and we really have a good time of pity, we want to wallow around a little bit in our pity when we're having some difficulties and times are hard. And we say, "Lord, all of my friends have forsaken me. I stand by myself. I'm the only one that's trying to do what's right. Everybody else is weak and indifferent. And I'm just, I don't understand. Just go ahead and take my life. I'm ready to go." And that was how Elijah felt. And yet God finally, as he spoke to him, convinced him that there had been 7,000 yet who had not bowed the knee to Baal, that he had preserved. And Elijah, like all mankind, goes through ups and downs. Now, in the 20th chapter, we're introduced to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, and his challenging to war against Ahab. And it's interesting because, first of all, he sends down messengers and he says to Ahab, "I'm going to come down and I'm going to take your wives and I'm going to take your possessions." And Ahab seems quite agreeable to that. And then he says, "I'm going to come down, I'm going to go in your house, and we'll take anything I want." Ahab says, "No, you're not." And we have this conflict now. This is an ongoing conflict between the north and the south kingdoms, and then Syria just to the north of Israel. And so Ahab says this, and listen to the statement in chapter 20 and in verse 20. Ben-Hadad rather says this: "The gods do so unto me, and more so if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls of all the people that follow me." And the king of Israel answered and said, "Tell him, let not him that girdeth on his armor boast himself as he that putteth it off." You know what that statement means? I tell my friends sometimes that when they want to boast about how good they are at golf. They want to talk a good fight. I say, "Let's wait till we get through. Then we'll know." You boast after the battle is over, not before the battle. Not when you put your armor on, but you have the right to boast when you take your armor off, when the fighting is done. So there is this conflict, and it says in verse 16, Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions, he and the kings, and when he is drunken, then Ahab comes and fights against him and conquers him. Now they conclude from that God is, as the God of Israel, is the God of the hills. And so he's strong when he's in the hills, but when the people are in the valleys, now he's not a god of the valleys, so he's not going to be strong. Next time we fight, we're not going to fight in the hills, we're going to fight down the valleys. And so God simply uses Ahab again to defeat Ben-Hadad. And it says in verse 28, "Thus saith Jehovah, because the Syrians have said Jehovah is a god of the hills, but he is not a god of the valleys, therefore will I deliver all this great multitude into thy hand, and he shall know that I am Jehovah." Now, their gods, in their estimation, some were gods of hills, some gods of valleys, some gods of this, some... they had limited powers. But God says, "I want you to know that my power is not limited." So Ben-Hadad is defeated. He goes into the city, into the inner part of the city, sends his servants down to Ahab, and calls upon the charity and the benevolence of Ahab to spare his life. And Ahab is agreeable, and he makes a covenant. And therefore, Ben-Hadad is spared from dying. And that is done so... at the imminent death of Ahab. The prophet is now, as he's going to meet Ahab, intended by God, approaches his servant, says, "Wound me," and he's smitten by the man, as you notice beginning in verse 35. He said, "Because thou hast obeyed the voice of Jehovah, behold, as soon as thou art departed from me, a lion shall slay thee." As soon as he was departed from him, a lion found him and slew him. That's a certain man of the prophets that refused to smite the prophet. He found another man, said, "Smite me, I pray thee." The man smote him, smiting and wounding him. Now that was all a part of what was going to be played out. Now Ahab comes along, and this servant now, smitten approaches him and proposes this scenario. While I was responsible to take one who was in my care, that I was busy here and there, and I didn't take care of it, and this man escaped. Now, what should happen? And Ahab said appropriately that he should pay with his life. And the prophet pointed out that God says, you're the man. And you're going to die because you spared the life of Ben-Hadad when God really wanted Ben-Hadad to die. In the 21st chapter, we're introduced to perhaps the best illustration, the most graphic illustration of the immoral behavior, just total lack of regard for what was right on the part of Ahab and Jezebel. And the story centers around Naboth, who has the vineyard. You know the story. And Naboth would not sell the vineyard to Ahab, and he would not trade the vineyard to Ahab because it was a part of his ancestral inheritance. So Ahab goes home, and he's very displeased, and he's unhappy, and he's just really discouraged, and Jezebel comes and, what's the matter? Well, he explains that he wants this field and this vineyard. Naboth won't sell it, and Jezebel proposes something, and I want you to look at how she works this thing out, and you tell me what kind of a woman would do something like this. We're going to throw a feast. We're going to have Naboth come as the guest. And then during the feast, we're going to have some men who are going to rise up against Naboth and accuse him of blasphemy. And then he will be stoned as a result of this, and you can have the vineyard. You're king. Why don't you understand that all these things are under your power? Yes, under your power if you're unscrupulous. But they didn't have any scruples against doing something like this. Naboth died because he was righteous. And they succeeded because they were unrighteous. Now, they didn't succeed for long. I want to call your attention to the 21st chapter and look at verse 21 and following, if you will. God says, behold, I will bring evil upon thee and will utterly sweep thee away in all, and will cut off from Ahab every man child, and him that is shut up and him that is left at large in Israel. And I will make thy house, you remember what I told you, mark the asterisk, like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. Three characters that are identifiable in the same way that would be left without descendants, and their sons would die in the streets and in the fields, and they would not be buried. They'd be eaten by the birds and by the dogs. And then it says in verse 23, and of Jezebel. Now, Ahab, you're going to die. All of your house is going to be killed. And of Jezebel, he says, the dogs shall eat Jezebel by the rampant of Jezreel. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city, the dog shall eat. Him that dieth in the field, shall the birds of the heavens eat. But there was none like unto Ahab, who did sell himself to do that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. Now, you notice in the case of Jezebel, and the case of Ahab, that he depicts Ahab as being so immoral. But then behind it, he says that Jezebel stirred up. Now, Ahab was not innocent because of the influence of Jezebel. But certainly she had a tremendous impact upon the behavior of Ahab. Ahab then repents in sackcloth and ashes. God at least sees that, and he approves of that. But it doesn't change what's going to happen. You have in the 22nd chapter, which is the close of the book of 1 Kings, in the history part of it, a confederation between the nation of Israel and the nation of Judah. At this time, you have Jehoshaphat, who is succeeded and who's ruling over the nation of Israel. Jehoshaphat over the southern kingdom of Judah, and Ahab, king over Israel. And now we're introduced to the kingdom of Syria, which again is just above this. And I want to pick up just a part of this and we'll briefly go on our way. Jehovah said in verse 20, who shall entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on this matter, another said on that matter. And there came forth the spirit and stood before Jehovah and said, I will entice him. Now the point that's being made by this, by Micaiah the prophet, is that the false prophets have prophesied in the way they have that you'll be successful, Ahab, and they've done so to entice you to come and to fight against the nation of Israel. But Ahab is going to die. Now, you notice when Jehoshaphat asked about prophets in the land, or all the prophets so far had come and said, go on up, you can win the battle. And he says, is there no other prophet? Ahab says, well, there's Micaiah, but I don't like Micaiah because he never says anything good about me. Now, I want you to notice as you read on the narrative here, it says in verse 21, there came forth the spirit, stood before Jehovah, and he said, I will entice thee to go forth. And then in verse 23, now therefore, behold, Jehovah hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these thy prophets, and Jehovah hath spoken evil concerning thee. Then Zedekiah, the son of Chenaana, came near and smote Micaiah on the cheek and said, which way went the spirit of Jehovah? Micaiah said, behold, thou shalt see on that day when thou shalt go into thy inner chamber to hide thyself. And then in verse 28, Micaiah said, if thou return at all in peace, Jehovah hath not spoken by me. And he said, hear ye, O people, all of you. So now they go up to battle. And what Ahab proposes is that Jehoshaphat disguise himself to look like him. And they go into battle, and the Syrian army then follows after the one that they think is Ahab. And Jehoshaphat is now being chased, and he cries out, and so when they see that he sees that he's not the king of Israel, then they quit the chase. Now here is God's providence. Just for chance, a person draws back the bow and shoots an arrow. It's per chance. He's not aiming at anybody. But perchance, he shoots this arrow, and it penetrates the armor of Ahab. And Ahab sees that he's dying, and he tells his chariot driver to drive him away. He's sitting up in the chariot, propped up, and he dies. His body is taken back to Samaria to be buried. And as he's died, his blood has poured out in the chariot itself, and they take the chariot. As you come to the 37th and 38th verses, chapter 22 and verse 38, they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood, according unto the word of Jehovah which he spake. Here's how God works in his providence. The arrow was launched for chance, and it hit in the exact spot that penetrated the armor of Ahab. And Ahab died, but he was in the battlefield. But his blood poured out in the chariot. And then the chariot was taken back to be washed in Samaria. And when the chariot was washed out, the dogs licked up his blood. That's what God had prophesied. And it came to pass exactly as God said. So Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah, his son, ruled in his stead. And you find a little part about Jehoshaphat. And then we come down to the last part in verse 50. Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers, was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father, and Jehoram, his son, reigned in his stead. And Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria, the 17th year. In verse 53, and he served Baal and worshipped him and provoked to anger Jehovah, the God of Israel, according to all his father had done. Now that brings us through a period of time in the worst part of the southern kingdom and the part of the northern kingdom, especially the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom is a kingdom that is noted for its idolatry, and that's the reason that it falls almost 100 years before the southern kingdom does. Now let's bring all of that into focus and bring it to a conclusion to try to impress this on our minds. I don't expect that you're going to remember all these names. 2 weeks from now, I think you'll remember Abishag because of the illustration, and perhaps Adonijah. And you won't forget Ahab and Jezebel, but you probably will forget about Micaiah, and you'll forget about Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, and you'll forget about some of the other characters because they're not as outstanding. They don't impress us as some of the others do. And just a lot of names in history. You'll forget about those things. But here are some things that we need to remember as we look through the books of history. That God has always expected His people to be loyal and faithful. And when they are loyal and faithful and obedient, He exalts them. He cares for them. He provides for them. Not without times of difficulty. Look at the life of Elijah. While God cared for Elijah, Elijah also experienced times of difficulty. The loss of his own life. And this is true of us. We will experience difficulties in life. And yet the things that we know from God and His divine providence is His care and protection of us, that whatever happens that men may do to us, they cannot affect our soul. And the faithfulness of men like Elijah ought to encourage us. So we're not learning just about history for the sake of learning about the books of the Bible, how they all fit together, but the very important lessons that we can learn from that. We don't want to be like Ahab and Jezebel. We see the end of that. But we want to be like Elijah, the strength and the character to stand for right and to stand against what's wrong. And that demands of us tremendous sacrifice. It demands of us, first of all, a commitment, a total commitment to God, that we're going to do what God says regardless of what happens. But that spirit that you see in Elijah is a spirit that we need to have in us as well. Let me encourage you to learn that lesson. As you look at the terrible background in which Elijah, he certainly is the bright spot in the history of Israel at this time. Now, as a Christian tonight, if you have not stood against evil as you should, if you have succumbed to the world and you've compromised and you've been weak and indifferent, God does not hold out promise for that. He promises He will give you strength if you're willing to repent of that and ask forgiveness and come back to it. And you can have that strength and you can be like Elijah was. It's in your capacity, but it has to be your choice. Why not tonight make that stand with God like Elijah made a long time ago? If you're not a child of His, why not tonight take your stand on the Lord's side? Stand for right, stand against what's wrong. Because then you have the approval that God gave to a character like Elijah. If you need to, won't you come as we stand and sing the selected song?